From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, will up north cottages become a thing of the past?
You put up a cute log place on one of these trout streams, you're all proud of it, you get a good price on it, you post it on the internet, you do a mailing, and you get zero response. And it's just like, oh my goodness, what's going on here?
What's in the new state budget for K-12?
Parents should be expecting that their kids aren't going to be going to school longer as time goes on, just because the push seems to be, let's increase the length of the school year.
And why is the HIV infection rate at a 15-year high in parts of Michigan?
It's our young folks who are mostly the new positives right now. We had 10 new cases between the ages of 15 and 24. That is unheard of.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Every movement has its landmarks and history. That holds true for the gay rights movement. Big cities across the country have had their LGBT history told, but what about Detroit? I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, a look at the largely unknown history of Detroit's gay community. But first, things may be in summer vacation mode in Lansing and through Michigan, but come fall, the new state budget kicks in, affecting every aspect of Michigan life. All this week, we'll dig into the new $53 billion budget. Today, money for K-12 education. There's nearly $14 billion. Who's getting what? MLive education reporter Brian Smith is with me. Brian, last week, we talked about that MEEP curveball, the one keeping the old test instead of the new assessment test keyed to the Common Core. It's a huge challenge for all involved. Today, the meat of the matter. You've got Democratic critics accusing Governor Snyder of gutting public education, and then you have the governor saying, not so. This year's education budget is $1 billion more than it was in 2010, the year before he took office. What is your take on that?
Well, it's really sort of an interesting debate because it depends on how you do the math and what you include and what you don't. A lot of the debate has centered on whether or not you include increased retirement costs in that calculation, because there are some who say that you shouldn't include the extra money that schools are contributing toward the retirement costs for teachers now, and there are others who say that absolutely money that's in the budget that supports that should absolutely be counted in terms of education spending. And so there's been a lot of back and forth on whether or not there's been this $1 billion cut. At MLive, we've looked at it and sort of found that while there have been some cuts and there have been some additions, it's nowhere near that $1 billion number that seems to be getting thrown around a lot.
Got to be part of the problem is it's just so dense and so complicated, and it's hard to understand.
Absolutely. It's incredibly complex, and it takes a lot of effort just to sort of understand even the basics of what's been added and what's been taken out.
Per pupil funding is really causing a debate. Why so?
Well, it's been because the way that money has been contributed has caused some debates among people. Every district is getting a minimum extra $50, but then districts that were getting less money per pupil than other schools are getting some additional money to sort of catch up, and that's going to be up to 175 total in terms of equity payments. But a lot of that money is going to go to schools that have some lower costs. A lot of charter schools and online schools are going to be included in that group that get the additional funding. And so that's giving them even more money. Critics say that they don't need the extra money because they have lower costs overall. A lot of the charters, for example, don't provide transportation. Their teachers aren't paying into the state's teacher retirement system. And districts that could use that extra money, that these people say, are the ones that are struggling financially anyway, and the money that they're getting isn't even going to keep up with the cost of inflation.
When you look at the pie, traditional schools, charter schools, online schools, what does that pie look like?
Well, obviously, your traditional schools are getting a large chunk of that money just because they have the most legacy costs in terms of not only health care and teacher retirement, but the fact that they've been around the longest, they have the largest districts in most cases. And so they suck up a lot of that money, and then the charters receive less, the virtual schools receive less. And while they're certainly doing a lot, if not more in some cases, with that reduced funding, there's been a lot of push from the charter school lobby to sort of make funding equal across all types of schools and make sure that the traditional schools and the charter schools and the virtual schools are all receiving that same sort of per pupil money.
What effect will this have, according to the critics? What are they afraid we're going to see?
Well, the people who are really concerned about the schools not getting more money, the traditional schools who aren't getting some of those that larger boost, they're concerned that basically the money they're getting isn't going to keep up with their increased costs. Obviously, as inflation continues, things become more expensive, and the additional money that they're getting doesn't make up for what it's going to cost them to keep operating for the next year, and so they're going to wind up, you know, potentially being a few dollars behind per pupil where they were a few years ago. There are people who would like to see a lot more money put into actual per pupil education. And it's a debate between sort of where we want to spend the majority of this school aid budget. Obviously, there's money in the school aid budget devoted to things other than K-12 classroom instruction. But it's really a fight over how we want to spend this, you know, large sum of money that we're setting aside for schools every year.
Well, what are they afraid it's going to be like for the students? What would be the impact that critics fear for a kid sitting in a classroom?
Well, obviously, you know, we have about 48 to 50, depending on where we are in the year, basically school districts that are running a deficit, and that includes charter schools as well. And so what they're dealing with is having to cut resources, cut classes, cut programs to make up that budget shortfall. And people who would like to see more money put into classroom education say that those cuts are happening because there's been money taken out, and if we don't put that money back in and sort of give these schools something closer to what they had even, you know, 5 years ago, that they're going to have to continue cutting things and we're going to have more districts that fall into deficit.
And who's in favor of the way that this per pupil funding formula is structured?
Well, it was sort of a compromise agreement between a lot of people. There had been discussions about various different ways that you could do it and the amount of money that was going to be added. The debate was really over how much additionally we can put in. Obviously, there were projections that it was going to be a larger surplus the state was going to have that could be put toward education. The revenue estimating conference ended up coming back and saying that there wasn't going to be quite that much money. The governor had called for adding $150 million overall, which would have worked out to between $83 and $111 per pupil. That number got trimmed back in both the House and the Senate in their different versions. And then the final version pushes it to $177 million, but the actual increase is different because of the way it's allocated. And so that's why you have that minimum $50, and then some districts get an additional equity payment on top of that.
We're looking at money for K through 12 in the new state budget with MLive education reporter Brian Smith. The issue of snow days worked its way into this budget. Brian, how so?
Well, there had been some debate over what we were going to do to make up snow days in the past, because you had districts that obviously with the winter we had this year couldn't make up all the days they had missed. And so the agreement was basically as long as a district had scheduled more than 174 days for instruction, as long as they made up that number of the number of hours that they were supposed to have, they didn't have to make up those additional days. And it's my understanding that's still in the budget for next year. Again, it's, as you pointed out, it's a very complex document, and there's a lot of language to it. So you have to do a lot of digging sometimes to find those little tidbits.
I guess parents and kids want to know, does what is in the budget mean longer days or longer school years for districts or shorter?
Well, the number of school days has been increasing over the last few years, and so parents should be expecting that their kids are going to be going to school fairly longer. There was, you know, a push to include some money for transitioning schools to an alternative calendar as well, where those days would be spread throughout the year. That money actually was taken out of the school aid budget and put into the general fund budget for some reason. It's not entirely clear why, but parents should be expecting that their kids are going to be going to school longer as time goes on, just because the push seems to be, let's increase the length of the school year.
Now let's talk about the little ones, the budget. What does it have for the Great Start Readiness Program?
Well, the governor pushed last year for adding $65 million to the Great Start Program to expand the availability of preschool services for lower-income families. And this budget includes an additional $65 million on top of that. So that's a $130 million increase over the last 2 years. And the governor sort of has championed this, going back to his State of the State speech at the beginning of the year, as making Michigan a no-wait state for preschool. Basically, if there's a student who qualifies for Great Start who wants to go to preschool, there will be a seat available for them. And this money creates enough half-day seats, so it wouldn't be a full day. It would be, you know, 4 hours. But they believe based on the calculations, that there should be enough space based on this level of funding for every child who would be eligible to actually attend.
Well, they wanted to knock down that waiting list for the pre-K education, and fingers crossed that it could happen.
It certainly seems like they have done the math to figure out how to do that.
Brian Smith, education reporter for MLive. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And tomorrow, we continue piecing together the new state budget. We'll look at how much money is flowing to higher education with a look at college and university budgets. I'm Cynthia Canty, and this is Stateside. Unsettling news in the war on HIV. Cases in Washtenaw County have hit a 15-year high, and that reflects trends being seen in Southeast Michigan and nationally. Why are HIV infection rates up, and among what populations? Kathy Wilchinski is a nurse practitioner at the Washtenaw County Health Department. AIDS and HIV just hit that 30-year mark. What's your take? How disappointing is this?
It's very disappointing. It's quite unsettling to see that the numbers are going up when we know the education is available for everyone out there, and trying to figure out why are they going up. I think the first thing on everyone's mind right now.
You look at 33 new cases reported in Washtenaw in 2013, up from 24 in 2012 and 21 in 2011. Which demographic group is seeing the most HIV increase?
It's our young folks who are mostly the new positives right now. We had 10 new cases between the ages of 15 and 24. That is unheard of. But the unfortunate part is the same thing is happening throughout the whole state of Michigan as well as nationally. So we are not any different than everybody else is, but we're trying to figure out why is that? Why are these young folks positive? Why are cases more African Americans, more men who have sex with men? We quite frankly don't know what that answer is.
Is it perhaps because the people over 30, so many lived through the AIDS crisis and they lost loved ones and they lost friends to AIDS, but the message doesn't seem real to the under 30s?
I certainly think that is. I think we need to come up with a new message. We need to figure out what message is going to work. I had someone tell me the other day that there's no ownership to that message anymore.
Some 80% of these new HIV cases, you touched on this in Washtenaw, involve men having sex with men, but that actually runs counter to what's being seen globally, where globally more cases are among men who have sex with women and women who have sex with men.
Right, exactly. And that's something that the United States has always been different in, that it's more men who have sex with men versus how it is internationally, which I think then your research is different. Your how you look at treatment may be different in that population versus the men who have sex with women and women who have sex with men.
When you're all sitting around and looking at each other and saying, look at this, what are we going to do? What kind of ideas come up?
The first idea that came up was we need to be asking those who are positive, the people that we do partner notification on, we need to ask them, what else can we do to help you? And start by helping them and then ask them, okay, now we need some help from you. What message would have helped you? What would have possibly made you think twice and that you would have protected yourself as well as your partner? And so that's where we're starting. And then working with our collaborators in the community, working with the HIV/AIDS Resource Center, our healthcare providers that we know have a large burden with positive cases, and chatting with them and saying, what else can we do together? Because not one individual entity or healthcare entity is going to solve this issue. It's got to be everybody working together to come to an answer.
What part, Kathy, do you think HIV testing plays in the increased rates? Are more people getting tested, so therefore incidence rates are up?
And it was probably about 2 years ago that there was a big push for primary care testing. Everybody test. That could be a part of it. I don't think we're aware of that yet. We don't know. It's hard to gather data from individual providers. How many people are you testing? We certainly can gather the data on how many people are positive, but we don't know all the non-reactive or negative tests out there. We do know that when people test, there's about a quarter of the people who don't go back for the results. So, you know, the numbers actually could be much higher than what they are reflected, because people don't always want to hear, you know, what that answer is going to be of, is it a positive test or not?
You're there in the trenches. You're really trying to fight this war. Do you think everyone should be tested for HIV?
I do believe everybody should know their status. I think it's a matter of get into your healthcare provider, test in primary care. I think if we test as make it a norm, we may have better conversations about it, and that we might make it so we can have give and take question and answer periods, and we can ask questions of how do I protect myself? How do I have a healthier sexual relationship?
Kathy Wilchinski is a nurse practitioner and program supervisor at the Washtenaw County Health Department. Thanks, Kathy.
You're welcome. Thank you, Cynthia.
The gay rights movement has its landmarks. In New York, the Stonewall Inn and Christopher Street. San Francisco has the Castro and Market districts. But what of Detroit? LGBT historian Tim Retzloff realized there was a rich history in Detroit's gay community that hadn't been properly told. That omission has now been corrected with the dissertation that earned Tim Retzloff his Ph.D. from Yale. Two volumes, 680 pages, taking an exhaustive look at gay life and history in the city and its suburbs from 1945 to 1985. Tim, you're from Flint and you now live and teach in East Lansing. Why did you want to take this detailed look at Detroit?
I grew up in Flint, which is not the most gay-friendly town in the 1980s, which is when I would have been coming out. Mm-hmm. The primary outlets were bars. Michigan, you know, you had to be 21 to drink. So my first time in a gay bar in Flint, I was kicked out. Mm-hmm. So I eventually found I found an organization called Dignity Flint, which was nominally Catholic, but basically functioned as kind of a gay men's group in the city for its long history. And that kind of helped me kind of bridge that gap. But certainly in high school, when I was first realizing, you know, who I was, yeah, it was a very difficult time.
So this dissertation drove you back to college and kind of put you, it pulled you right through to the point where you're sitting here today with this history that you've done. Did you have some hypothesis or mission statement that you were writing to, or did you just dig and report what you found?
Once I realized I wanted to, you know, write the dissertation, I went back to school. And I was working full-time here at the University of Michigan and started taking classes part-time. And one of the first classes I took was A History of American Suburbia with Matthew Laster. And it was in the midst of that class that things suddenly clicked, because all this material I'd found on Detroit suddenly started making sense. Detroit had a different story than what you were finding in New York and San Francisco or even the other cities that had been done. So with Detroit, it's really Metro Detroit, and it's very much a picture of looking at both the suburbs and the cities. And right now, if you look at LGBT activism in Detroit, you know, the Affirmations Community Center is in Ferndale, mm-hmm, kind of the centers of gay nightlife, and organizations are Royal Oak and Ferndale.
They moved just ever so slightly north of Palmer Woods.
But they're there, yeah, they're in residentially, mm-hmm, certainly. Mm-hmm. There's the inner ring suburbs. So that's a different, but then at the same time, you've got kind of this rich African-American gay life that's still going on in the city. And up until really the 1990s, bar life was in the city. So you've got, you know, at its peak in the mid-80s, you've got like 50 gay bars. All but two or three of them are in Detroit. They have a largely white clientele.
Coming from the burbs.
Coming from the burbs. So you've got kind of that relationship going on.
That you don't see as much in New York or in Chicago or San Francisco.
Right. And so the geography is different.
The geography is different. But the result is?
The result is, I think, a different kind of gay politics in some respects.
How so?
Well, I think the kind of transition from gay liberation into what happened in Detroit, the first organization after gay liberation, was founded in 1975, called the Association of Suburban People.
When would you give us a sense of the time frame for the gay lib movement?
Sure,
it
sure.
Arose.
There were the first organization in Detroit was a very short-lived chapter of the Mattachine Society, which lasted 17 months from 58 to 60. And it was a group that was very, very fearful of being exposed. So people were afraid to even use their names. They were afraid to have public meeting spaces. But they had a couple of achievements, one of which was they produced a newsletter. So it's kind of the first kind of gay-generated organ of disseminating information. Once that folded, the next organization that started in Detroit actually started in Grosse Pointe. It was a group called One in Detroit. It was founded by a Grosse Pointe travel agent and former school teacher named Chet Sampson, who had moved to Los Angeles and felt a little more open to come out, but he still had ties to Detroit, and he started this organization.
Okay.
And now we use the word closeted. For this time period, it might be more accurate to say they were more masks, because the sense of the closet wasn't what it was until later.
And keeping in mind, at this time, homosexuality was still considered a mental illness.
It was considered
right?
a mental illness. Yeah. It was certainly criminal at the time and highly stigmatized. Mm-hmm. And yet you had people who were gay, of course, and people who were gay in the cities and in the suburbs that were invested in keeping their secret because of their job, because of their family, because of their home. So One in Detroit was kind of this organization that actually bridged Stonewall and gay liberation, and it was still going out, and they were the old fogies in the early 70s. So 1970 was when the gay liberation movement started in Detroit, soon became the Gay Liberation Front, in part from the spark of Stonewall and that wave across the country, but also, much like other gay liberation, built on the counterculture movement, the anti-war movement, the Black Power movement,
everything
feminism,
that was going on.
It's all exactly.
When I think about all of that, and so much of the time frame of your dissertation is long before that. You're looking at 1945 to 1985. Why that time span?
So 1945. So World War II is seen as kind of a major turning point for kind of the emerging gay subculture nationally, in part because of the conditions of the war and how it brought people together in certain cities like never before. So someone who might have, you know, had crushes down on the farm
in Kansas, yes.
Or northern Oakland County was suddenly in a city, maybe mobilized, so they're suddenly in troops and being deployed and having exposure to a gay world that they might not have known existed. And in Detroit, certainly that was going on because Detroit was the arsenal of democracy.
So many coming to work in the factories.
Right, right.
So it blew the lid off things for a lot of people at a time when it wasn't safe to be out.
Right, right. And so, and simultaneous with this is 1945, you see the beginning of the post-war suburbs. So I was kind of telling both of these stories simultaneously. So that's why the beginning point is. The end point at 1985 is for a couple reasons, one of which is I attended my first Pride March in 1986. And as a historian, I believe I shouldn't be part of my history that I'm writing.
So it's a good place to cut it off, yeah.
But also for Detroit, by the mid-80s, you see kind of the end result of this trend toward the suburbs, and you see the early impact of AIDS, which was delayed from other cities or in the country. There was kind of a lag time, but it did hit Detroit as well. So that kind of changes the story too. And so, unless I want to extend it another 10 years, 1985 seemed like the natural point.
Based on all the research you've done, how would you characterize or describe Metro Detroit's gay community from that time period in that 40 years?
Emerging and growing in very interesting ways. I mean, geographically dispersing from an area where the bars were centered right downtown to over time kind of being spread throughout the city, in part depending on where the expressways were built. Mm-hmm. But then kind of reacting to national trends and events politically in its own unique way. So the Anita Bryant campaign in 1977, where she had the Save Our Children campaign and successfully pushed for the repeal of a human rights ordinance in Miami-Dade County, Florida. The response in Detroit was to mobilize. And Detroit had already, you know, had at least established enough of an infrastructure where they brought in people from various organizations, but also people involved in bar life, in Metropolitan Community Church, which is a primarily gay and lesbian church, to kind of say, we don't want that to happen here, and establish the Michigan Organization for Human Rights, which really is kind of the early manifestation of what became Equality Michigan. So we've kind of got this continuity thread from there to today.
But isn't it interesting, as we sit here in 2014, the Elliot Larson Act still is missing in one rather large clause.
Exactly, and was an early project of the Michigan Organization for Human Rights.
How do you think this process of what you've gone through, all this research and the writing and the thinking and the talking to people, how has that affected or impacted the way you see yourself as a gay man in Michigan in 2014?
I did a fair amount of some of my research at the Library of Michigan in Lansing. And so I've become acquainted with Leroy Barnett, who is the former archivist for the state. And he would, you know, periodically check in with me. And so when I was finally done, I wanted to show him the finished dissertation. And so I loved him. I loved watching him look through that. But he made this point to me. It was like, okay, you need to remember who you were as a kid. And what the story is, what the story is from there to here. So kind of in response to your question, you know, there's kind of this lonely 17-year-old. And, you know, certainly my personal experience has led me to understand I'm not the only one in the world. But now that I know kind of this rich history, not only am I not the only one in the world, but, you know, 40, 50 years ago, people were not the only ones in the world. It was just kind of a different configuration of how society was, and that it was much, much harder to find people. But people were able to find people, and that is kind of the stunning story, that this myth that people were isolated and invisible and perpetually scared is much more complicated than that, and that there was constant rejection. Everybody, you know, this idea that everyone felt they had to move to San Francisco. Well, yes, lots of people moved to San Francisco, but lots of people stayed. And to what extent were their families maybe more welcoming? And maybe how does that complicate our understanding of why marriage is such a big issue right now and how that happened so quickly? You know, the New York and San Francisco don't explain that. Life in the suburbs does.
Sounds like a new book. Tim Retzloff, who has just completed his dissertation, earned his PhD from Yale on his gay history of Detroit, the gay rights movement and the history of gay life in Detroit and its suburbs, teaching at Michigan State University. Tim, thank you for talking with
us. Thank you very much.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In 1971, my firefighter dad decided we were in a position to take the plunge, buy a little cottage up north. He found a place, one big room that served as living room, kitchen, and eating space. One bathroom, one bedroom. It was tucked alongside the Manistee River near Kalkaska. We had our cottage. That was such a big part of the Michigan dream for so many members of the middle class. But 43 years after my folks bought that Kalkaska cottage, things are very different in the up north cottage market. John Beck is an associate professor at the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations at Michigan State University. Welcome, Professor.
Great to be on with you, Cynthia.
And Craig Hinkle is a broker owner at RE/MAX in Grayling. Good to have you with us, Craig.
Thank you, and I look forward to the conversation.
I actually want to start with you, Craig. Something tells me guys like Captain Milt Bruce were really the bread and butter for guys like you.
Absolutely. You mentioned the Manistee River, and and that is a real classic trout fishing stream in some beautiful properties along that river. And I understand your father's dream, and it's a dream of a lot of people to have a spread on that river. So I understand how that's a dream, and I have a cabin on the Asabo River, so and it's only 6 miles from my house. But when I want to get away from it, that's where I go, and it is a special place. So.
Well, John Beck, when did that middle class push to have a place up north start?
Well, that I think that a lot of it is by what we call the golden era kind of labor relations in the United States. So post-World War II, you get this rise of income from about 1950 to the middle of the 70s, where income is really rising each year. People who traditionally, we think of as working class, truly became the working middle class. Many of them were able to send their children to college for the first time, a variety of other things. And cottages, I think, were a large part of that. That is, it was a place to escape the heat of the city and everything else, and get on those roads and drive up north.
And so, Craig, when did that big push that John referred to, and during that golden era of labor relations, when did you see that start to change? What did you see there in the trenches of the up north real estate market?
Well, just to elaborate with John, I started in the business in 1979, so I've been in about 35 years. And when I started, the I'm going to call them clientele that John talked about, mm-hmm. They already had a foothold. The big three, those people already were planted. They had their place, and it continued to go. Right up until the recession, probably, and that started in our area late 2006 and 2007.
John, it seems like when you think of what Craig just referred to with the Great Recession, talk about a perfect storm. You have the housing market collapse, the auto companies laying off and cutting pay, the Great Recession really clobbered Michigan, people's 401ks went down the drain, and a lot of kids wound up moving out of state, so they weren't in a position to take over the cottage from mom and dad, or they were too financially strapped and couldn't keep up the taxes. Did I miss anything?
I think there's a number of things that this perfect storm gets a little more perfect, perhaps, because what you have in that period when Craig first started selling houses, you still had a lot of people with kind of the reaping the benefit of an earlier era, so high wages after kind of 3% on average kind of increases over 2.5 decades. Wages flatten out in the mid-70s. So you get that beginning to have an effect on people. You have far less people required to make automobiles, for example. And then two-tier wage agreements and other things that have a number of people coming in with lower wages than many of the people that they're working with. There was also the reality, and I think all of us who have children watch this happen, that rising college costs, more parents sending their kids to college, you had competing costs that frankly had a huge impact on your ability to buy property, for example, because it was diverted instead into rising college tuitions.
Boy, that does spell it all out, and I've seen that play out in our family. That is absolutely how it played out. If you've just joined us, we are talking about the cottage culture and what has happened over the years from what had been that big push for the Michigan middle class to get that little cottage up north. We're speaking with John Beck, who's a professor at the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations at Michigan State University, and with Grayling broker owner, Remax and Grayling, Craig Hinkle. Craig, looking at all of this, this kind of perfect storm that John so well spelled out, how is this affecting the market today and your business today in Grayling?
It makes it very challenging because we have a whole bunch of folks that need to sell their property. They're not quite healed up from the recession, and we have just a huge inventory of properties in very little interest. I go back 10 years. And I'm going to pick the Manistee River and the Asabo River. There was a huge shortage. We would obtain a listing, we would simply call people.
And I honestly remember selling properties sight unseen to buyers because they knew it was a good investment. They were getting double-digit returns of appreciations annually. And I would sell property sight unseen.
When was that, Craig? When do you think, when was that happening?
Probably up to 2 years before the recession. So probably in the years 2001 to 2004, we were just going gangbusters. And people just knew, and the word was out that if you can acquire something on one of these trout streams, that it's a no-brainer and it's going to go up in value. And it was a fun ride.
And today that ride is over, so you have a lot of inventory.
The ride is over. The inventory, our shelves are just full of inventory. It used to be Riverfront was our number one seller, and it's just not anymore. And you get all excited. You put up a cute log place on one of these trout streams. You're all proud of it. You get a good price on it. You post it on the internet. You do a mailing, and you get zero response. And it's just like, oh, my goodness, what's going on here?
So. Wow. And, you know, I got to wonder, I'll just throw that out to whichever of you wants to address this, with the auto industry recovering, and we know people are not living in fear of layoffs as they once did, is it that two-tier pay system that is keeping people from, or have they just been so burned by the Great Recession that they're afraid to take that plunge and own a second home?
Well, one thing that I would raise is that, Cindy, you raised something that's really important that your listeners really understand, which is that a lot of the demographic shift in terms of the makeup of the family, the kinds of things that family members do, let's posit two different families. Say in the early 1970s, you might have a third-generation auto worker who was working at Ford or Chrysler or GM, followed his father potentially or her father into the plant. They very well may have had a cottage up north that the family used as a refuge. Now, fast forward into the 1990s, it very well may be that all of the children of that 1970s auto worker live nowhere close to Michigan at all.
Yeah,
they're dispersed based on what they're doing in terms of their specific jobs. Their children are doing weekend soccer and other kinds of things during the summer. So much of the tie to a cottage that was a getaway means now that you're going to be missing things that fundamentally, you know, you've signed your children up for. They have more club and kind of camp opportunities than before. And two-income families means that you can't necessarily assume that someone's going to be at the cottage for six straight weeks because that individual doesn't work. You know, so that the big changes in families and activities, I think, is really put a strong nail into the coffin of the usability of a family cottage.
Craig, what do you see?
It's funny, John, that you brought that up because three times in the last month I've gone out to list recreational properties, and we always ask the sellers, you know, something wrong. The buyers are always going to say, you know, why is the seller have it on the market? Why are they selling? And it goes right back to what John said. These people want, that are in their 60s and 70s, they want to go back to where their children are to watch their grandchildren participate in these summer events that are going on, the school events, the softball, the volleyball, all of these things the kids are so involved with, and it's pulling the parents back to return home to watch the grandchildren grow up, where 20, 30 years ago, that stuff wasn't available. They would come up to the cottage and spend the summer or a week or what have you. So
yeah,
that's an interesting point. I never thought about that until I just heard John. But three times in the last month, I've listed properties because people want to go be involved with the grandkids growing up and watch them in their sporting event.
The other major shift that I think that you have to always bear in mind is that our generation, the baby boom generation, is like this gigantic goat moving through the snake, okay?
Yes.
And it's those baby boomers that are sitting on top of a lot of that property. So that as they try to sell property, there's simply less people you know, that demographic group is just dominating cottage ownership, and that a lot of their kids aren't making the same kind of money that their parents did. So the ability to simply turn a cottage over to your child, there might be problems in terms of you know, how much taxes you're going to be paying on that specific piece of property. I mean, there's been a huge shift, I think, that's having a great amount of effect on what Craig is looking at in terms of his market.
We absolutely saw that in our family, because the family member to whom my parents left the cottage couldn't keep up the tax payments and had to sell and take a great big hit. So I'm sure that that has been just repeated and repeated. I just wonder, to both of you, could you see a scenario where today's young people are tomorrow's middle-aged parents with a family, where maybe a cottage does seem like a better idea, the way it did to my dad after 23 years of marriage? Or has our lifestyle changed to the point, like you say, we've got the summer soccer leagues, we've got, you know, we want to see our kids doing all these things. Has that ship sailed?
Well, I can speak for myself. I have a cottage on the Asabo River, and I have three boys. And I'm a very avid outdoorsman. I do all the fly fishing. We archery hunt. We do all kinds of hunting. My three boys have zero interest in going to the cabin and doing any of that. They're all in the technology era. You know, if we don't have Wi-Fi, if I can't do this, if I can't communicate, if I can't, it just, and I'm just speaking for myself, but I see it all the time. The people tell me that the children and grandchildren have just little interest in the boating or whatever the outdoor activities might be. So, yes. Yeah.
One thing that I would raise, I think that Craig was absolutely on target in relation to Wi-Fi and everything else, is that a lot of people are using their cottages as simply doing work in a different place. So that flexibility based on Wi-Fi and other things up north has allowed people maybe to spend more time at some of their cottage properties than they would have in the past. But I think that the ability simply to spend time away in a different place will always be of great benefit to families and to individuals. And I think that cottages, the cachet of them will continue. The issue is whether or not the investment value that Craig was mentioning will continue to be upheld. I think that a lot of folks have thought of property as something that was, you know, frankly, their nest egg, whether it be the family home or the family cottage. And I think some of those days very well may have sailed compared to the desire of people to actually get away.
Well, you both make me want to be up north in the woods right now, I'm going to tell you that. Great conversation as we look at kind of the shifting scene of Michigan's cottage on the lake lifestyle, as we've been speaking with John Beck, associate professor at the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations at Michigan State University, and with Craig Hinkle, who's the broker owner of RE/MAX in Grayling. Thank you so much to both of you for speaking with us today.
You bet, Cindy.
And thank you.
That perfect storm that caused so many to put their cottages on the market does have an upside. If having a cottage is on your radar screen, you could be in luck. John Carr is a broker with Coldwell Banker in Harbor Springs. John, the area you serve has a few identities, I would suspect, from very upscale year-round homes to very upscale second homes to more modest cottages?
That's correct. We have a lot of very, very nice homes on the water, but an equal number of nice cottages that are have a view of the water, or maybe are on the inland a little bit, but have easy beach access.
How long have you been a broker?
Oh, a long time. I think it's 27 years now.
Can you kind of just take us through the track that you've seen the housing prices taken for these, especially these second homes?
Since the meltdown in 2008, you know, every year there's a certain number of families that put their cottages on the market, you know, for the typical reasons. You know, they're just not being used anymore. There's a death in the family. The kids don't come up and visit. And every year there's also a certain number of buyers. And usually there'd be a more or less equal number of buyers and sellers. After 2008, you know, all bets are off. There are still those cottages coming on the market and very few buyers. So, you know, simple economics, supply and demand, the you know, prices have plummeted. So there's a lot of affordable, even the higher end properties have come down 30 or 40%. But the affordable ones, you know, you can be on the water in a cottage for under, say, $300,000, $400,000, or a nice view cottage with a view of Lake Michigan for under $200,000.
Hmm. Give me some of the rock bottom priced ones. What would you get for how little? I'm just kind of curious to get the scale from, like you
sure.
say, something $300,000 gets you on the lake. How low do they go?
I have a cottage listed for $179,000, two bedrooms, nice. Cute cottage, nice view with lake access for $179,000. That's probably the best value out there.
And based on what you've seen in that kind of Harbor Springs, Petoskey area, is this about as low as you've ever seen?
Absolutely. No, the prices have never gone down in this area before. They always, I mean, you're really in the 90s, they were going up 30, 40, 50% a year.
You've probably got folks that are kind of almost trapped in those second homes, aren't they, where they almost can't afford to sell them at the prices way they are.
Absolutely. Yeah, particularly, you know, the old family cottages where, you know, there's, you know, three or four kids and a bunch of grandkids. You know, the parents have passed away, and the kids are trying to keep it. The kids are dispersed all throughout the United States. The taxes, you know, for non-homestead are extremely high. If you have a property that's valued at $500,000, your taxes are, you know, $10,000, $15,000 a year. That's tough for these families to keep. So that's why some of these houses are so relatively reasonable now.
So bottom line, John Carr, why buy now?
You're never going to see prices this low again.
John Carr is a broker with Coldwell Banker in Harbor Springs, and appreciate your sharing your insights with us, John. Thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Oh, my pleasure. You're welcome.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Taylor Mattia, Omar Saadeh, Kayla Steinberg, Katie Suha, and Brianna Tinsley. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.